here. And he'll be, he's from the University of Western Australia, and he'll be talking about musical instrument data.
Thank you. Are we ready? Okay. During the last year, I've spent a considerable amount of time in Western Australia, in Perth, working with this John Blacking collection that Andrea talked to you about. And my job was to evaluate the collection, to make recommendations for future use of the ethnographic materials in the collection. And this is a collection, as you know, of a prominent anthropologist and ethnomusicologist. An ethnomusicologist myself, with a background also as a sound archivist and a museum curator, I've been particularly interested in several key areas in the collection. And we will. My first look at the archives, and it's always the anticipation and then the experience of, oh, what does John Blacking's archive look like? And my first look was surprising. It is not entirely organized. It is in process. But as I looked around at the collection, the first thing I thought about as an ethnomusicologist was repatriation, and especially of the media materials, because it's so there's such significant material that would be valued so highly, and in many would argue so much more highly in the heritage communities. After briefly exploring the papers that had been carefully reorganized by some well-meaning librarians, I opened large plastic bins. Some of you who do archives know that this is not such a great thing, filled with CD dubs of reel-to-reel tapes that to me comprise the heart of the collection. For most of us who work in the field, it is the musical sound that offers the greatest opportunity for understanding music in both social and cultural contexts, and for communicating with our friends and colleagues in the field, in the local communities in which we work. I've also been fascinated for years by musical instruments and the tales each instrument tells. I quickly became aware that instruments offered a pathway to musical knowledge for John Blacking. I enjoyed the opportunity sharing this experience with Blacking and learning about individual musicians and instrument makers. I considered the future, the instrument makers and the instruments and the performance practices. And throughout the year, I considered the future value of this and use of this and other collections developed by ethnomusicologists during the last 60 to 70 years. Musical sounds, photographs, drawings, narrative information, interpretive phrases, while old and even in some cases dated, are rich. As many of you are aware, accessing and using these data cannot take place without considerable, carefully focused work on the part of archivists, curators, scholars, and educators. My paper addresses one discussion topic related to this process. This is an example of the kind of document that I found and the kind of question that was raised, who is going to look after the reed flute grove of the people who are moved by the government? That's rich, and not a lot of other context, and so I had to unpack some of that. Musical instruments and documentation about instrument construction and use kept outside of their source communities and storage or on display in archives, private collections, and museums are often presented as objects with geographic tags, measurements, and identifying names and numbers. Organology, the academic study of musical instruments, has framed an approach to the collection, storage, research, and display of instruments that has been used for generations. Organologists then define instruments primarily by their descriptions, dimensions, classification, and sound. Archivists and museum specialists today do recognize instruments as cultural objects that embody both tangible and intangible heritage, but few express engagement with the complex roles these sources for musical sound play in the local communities that once supported them. In ethnomusicology, many of us have shifted away from organological approaches to understanding musical instruments to engage more fully in ethnographic studies that offer in-depth information on instruments and the people that produce and use them. One of the early researchers to address ethnography and musical instruments, whose work has played a key role in shaping ethnomusicological research since the 1960s, is Alan Merriam. His ethnographic document on drum making among the Basonge people, published in Ethnomusicology in 1969, serves as an early model for scholars with an interest in instrument making. Merriam provides a detailed account of the process around constructing a drum, demonstrating how one instrument came to life. He offers a view of drum making as a social and cultural process, revealing social patterns in, as he describes it, quote, an informal document of small group activity that delimits a small part of an economic system and provides an ethnographic slice of life, unquote. One of the key pieces of information on local values that Merriam offered occurred in a statement by the drum maker who said, quote, it is very important that we have the right kind of tree. Other studies on musical instrument production and use that have contributed to our understanding of musical instruments and sociality include key works between the 1960s and 2000, Regula Qureshi on sarangi and sarangi players in North India and Pakistan, John Bailey on tanbur in Afghanistan, Paul Berliner, well known for his work on Shona Mbira, Jonathan Stock on Arhu in China, and most recently, Kevin Daw in 2010, and actually in the decade before, has been doing a lot of work, the post-2000 era, where instrument-centered research by people like Kevin Daw, Tsai-Thun Wang, and now most, Alan Roda, on tabla in India, have introduced new approaches to ethnographic studies of musical instruments and their music. In fact, we are now embracing opportunities to explore the social life of the instrument itself. Furthermore, increasingly we recognize that our gathered knowledge on materials that are used for instruments combined with sociocultural data yields evidence of natural resource use that contributes to local and regional ecological histories. Many who document musical practices, curators, anthropologists, ethnomusicologists, conduct field projects today with a keen sense of social responsibility. But what of historical data collected and stored in homes, archives, and museums? Are museums really, quote, mausoleums, places for the display of the musically dead, with organologists acting as morticians, preparing dead instrument bodies for preservation and display, unquote? As ethnomusicologist Elliot Bates has suggested in a very recent article. Similarly, are archives places where musical instrument data is stored, typically without enough contextual information and connection to heritage communities to be used to initiate and maintain relationships with those who have the potential to be most invested in the material? How might we bring instruments and their documentation out of the old framework established in the 19th century to be more effectively understood as vibrant matter with complex relationships to people and other objects, nations, economies, and ecologies? And most importantly, to be part of a repatriation cycle involving individuals, institutions, and local communities. With this paper, then, I urge archivists, curators, ethnomusicologists to work together to frame a new or expanded approach to musical instrument knowledge, promotion, and care. I demonstrate that musical instruments and the narrative and visual information on production and use held in historical and contemporary collections are rich resources and contribute to knowledge about cultural, economic, and ecological vulnerabilities, adaptation, and resilience through their sounds, images, and stories. Recovering relationships between people and instruments and between instruments and their source environments can play a significant role in reframing our connections to music and to the communities that have shared their instruments with scholars, collectors, curators, and musicians. The ethnographic data on music and dance performance offered by John Blacking in archival collections at UWA and Queen's University, represent his work in southern and eastern Africa, provides examples of how musical instrument information has value for institutions supporting current research and repatriation and dissemination of local knowledge. The Black Ink Archive holds, as Andrea said, a number of different types of material, including audio and visual, manuscript field data, much of it collected in South Africa. I would mention there is material also from Australia, from PNG, and Ireland in that collection, because he did do some work in those areas as well. And more specifically, he worked not only with the Venda, as Andrea said, between 1956 and 58, but also with the Vale Tonga people and the Msenga people in Zambia, then Northern Rhodesia in 1957 and 1961, and with diverse groups in Uganda during a series of weekend field excursions in 1965. But clearly, the most in-depth information that he provides is on the Venda people, where he spent 22 months in the field in the 1950s. He began his musical studies in Africa in the 1950s, working with Hugh Tracy at the International Library of African Music. Tracy was a collector with a particular interest in documenting musical instruments and instrumental performance. Blacking continued his own studies during the following decades then, with an eye and ear for the material as well as the aural in music. Blacking's organization and documentation for all of his field data demonstrates his greatest interest was in audio recording. His methodology, probably adopted from Tracy, includes a system for logging information on each recording he made, identifying individual musical pieces, instrument tunings, etc. We have considerably more limited information on his films, nearly all, as you saw a few minutes ago, without sound, and the sound files are not clearly identified. Some films demonstrate efforts to construct stories about music that are less ethnographic and more experiential. Images available at UWA include slides, black and white prints, and a few negatives, but most are not labeled, although a numbering system applied to many of the slides helps to contextualize them. So I've used this material to apply some of my ideas around this issue of musical instrument, understanding musical instruments, and ultimately musical instrument repatriation. As you will note, I could use one of many, many different collections, but I have this at hand, and so we're going to go in this direction. Considering his audio images, diary entries, his film clips, his written research, his interests involved around specific instrument types. I'm not exactly sure where I am on here, sorry. You've already seen a map, so these are the areas that he was working in. So he was interested in musical bows, xylophones and lamellophones, end and side-blown flutes, side-blown animal horns and drums. Blacking gives musical instruments agency in his documentation, and the amount of information he offers on this subject provides opportunities for us, even 60 years after his fieldwork, to consider the sociality of specific instruments. His data was often description, included instrument names, construction, materials, makers, tunings, repertoire, and oral and visual documents on performance practice. He also, though, took the time to provide details that included names of parts, keys, tools, and to record information on process, like Merriam's work on Bala drum making, which it actually preceded Merriam's work. Among his data are descriptions and demonstrations of performance practices and social beliefs related to specific instruments, information on woods and other building materials, drawings and diagrams, images, etc. I'm going to talk about two different instrument types, one much more extended, and I hope I'm not going to run out of time here. Okay, so the one type of instrument is the, we'll call it mbila, because it's actually both, it's two types of instruments if we're talking about classification, the xylophone and the lamellophone. Blacking recorded detailed information on the xylophone and the lamellophone in all regions of Africa in which he was engaged in field work. He explored the structure of the instruments, their tunings, playing style, fingering, and hand patterns, and he recorded some of their construction techniques. The venda Mbila Mutondo, a xylophone, with no longer locally played, is preserved in images of performance and instrument making, as well as recordings and film clips. So here's an example of the kind of information. This is 2 of 4 pages on one particular interaction with an instrument and an instrument community, or a community in which this instrument was being played and documented. And it gives you an idea of the variety of information that he has made available, or that he was recording and is now available. Images. Of both performance and instrument making provide a lot of important information. The Mbira Madeza and Mbira Chipai are lamellophones that are rare today, as is this Mbila Mutondo, which I understand is not played. And they're representative of an instrument type that is found in different regions of Africa, using metal keys mounted on a soundboard or sound box played with the fingers and thumbs. The keys are typically made from locally sourced metal, such as bicycle spokes. Resonation for the instrument is sometimes provided by an added large gourd or tin, often with attached shells or bottle caps, to provide a highly valued timbral sound. And the soundboard most commonly was made also of Mutondo wood. So this is the same type of wood that was used for the xylophone. Gives you an idea of some of the drawings. Notation about the instrument. Oh my goodness. In the last clip that you probably didn't have a chance to read, he included in a diary entry, "The wood for Mbila is from Mutondo tree. People can be arrested if found with a piece of Mutondo." I'm going to skip a little bit because I want to talk a little bit more, talk now about another instrument, which is actually even more fascinating. And it's one of the more fascinating documents that I found in the collection this year. And it was 2 school notebooks compiled by one of his assistants, Alfred Balanganda. One of Blacking's 2 primary assistants, includes stories about performance events in Venda language in one book, and with translations into English in another. One narrative, most likely written by Alfred himself, is a personal story about Beka, a practice that no longer exists, involving visitation and competition among performers in different communities. Young people perform what is called shikona, which involves dance and instrument performance. It's complicated. The narrative that is in this document reveals the centrality of music and dance in the lives of community, the integration of music and musical instruments in social life, the significance of instruments in social and economic success, and in reinforcing established power relationships. So shikona is identified as the national dance of the venda, and also as a pipe dance, and traditionally that takes place under the supervision of local leaders and is associated with rituals. In fact, it has served different purposes in different eras. The flutes or pipes that are played during the shikona dance are made without holes, and performance involves the production of a single note, and multiple flutes play different pitches to create interpocketing or interlocking patterns. In this often quoted passage, Blacking notes that shikona is valuable and beautiful to the venda not only because of the quantity of people and tones involved, but because of the quality of relationships that must be established between people and musical tones whenever it is performed. I would also add, though, that the relationship between each performer and the bamboo flute itself, and the role of each piece of bamboo in the community of performers and the interaction of the flutes with one another are also critical to the success of the event. So let me just read a little bit from this document. Alfred begins, "In our district of Gaba, I still remember a shikona we played in 54. The shikona started while I was at school. When it closed in June, some boys went to visit in town and some went to work. But some of friends and I went to perform shikona. And when we got home, we found that indeed they were busy practicing, and we joined them. People came to see the dancing every day. The old men and women were dancing. One day our headman said to our leader, 'Tell my children that I will give them bepa because they are dancing very nicely. They will have this visitation opportunity.' His words were followed with many, with ululation and excitement. And when we boys heard this, flutes were blown in such a way that it was possible they would crack." And so he talks about how they played shikona all day, and at a certain point, the headman blew his kwata, his horn, and stood in the middle of the dancers, and then said, "Tomorrow, everybody, including girls, should come, and you must go to work, and your work is reaping corn, reaping mealies, but then you will have an opportunity to play shikona, to perform shikona." And so he signaled with the horn for them, for them to play. And then at the end of the day, he said, "Everybody must go home with his flute, because if you leave your flutes here, you may not come with us to work. And everyone who does not come tomorrow and stays home with their flute will be charged a sum of money or a hen. If the music does not sound right, they will know who is missing and which flute is not there." And then we asked the headman what time we must come for our work, and he said, "The kwata will tell you, I will blow it." The two instruments then play two social roles. One carries power, the solo horn, and the other the interdependence of community. In a diary entry from Blacking with information on shikona performance practice and tuning of Nanga flutes, he noted that when two communities meet, ostensibly to compete, they may be able to play together provided the pala of the chiefs agree. And the pala has been defined as a key note for the set of pipes. But in fact, what I learned as I looked at the diary is that the pala is also a flute. And it's kept in a special place, in a bag with other flutes. And the pala is not separate, as he said. It is marked with a special sign. If pala is lost, you have lost shikona. How else are you going to begin? I have more to say about Nanga, about this flute, which is really fascinating, but I'll just conclude. When instruments and instrument-related information are separated from location where they maintain relative social, cultural balance, the collectors, curators, archivists, and organizations take on roles as cultural heritage keepers, not always aware that the heritage they are holding has eroded over time in the source community. Musical instruments and their musics fade or disappear, particularly in socially and politically vulnerable places that have suffered economic decline, environmental degradation, and therefore cultural loss. Instruments, materials, playing style, social life, and relationships to ecological landscape need to be recaptured and returned to communities where they have the greatest value. This information embedded in images, diagrams, stories, clips, sounds will contribute to an ongoing dialogue about music, sociality, and the physical environment within communities, about instruments and social meaning, and the complexity of materiality in our understanding of musical performance. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jennifer. So we have questions straight away at the back there.
Thank you, Jennifer. This is absolutely fascinating. I was wondering, how do you see then the roles of the museum curator, the archivist, and the musicology in this process of repatriation? Would the ethnomusicologists be guided by the museum archivists and curators to go back into the field and tell and retell the stories that other musicologists have captured and preserved?
Well, I think that there are different approaches to this project, and we've heard pieces of it in the first two papers, that the collaborative approach, the ongoing and ever-changing collaborative approach to research that we have adopted during the last several generations is helping us to frame and reframe this. And I think what I'm doing with this paper is I'm putting us on notice. I don't have the plan set and the opportunity yet to actually put it into place, but I think that these are issues that have been left aside. It is important that archivists, curators, and people working in the field, if they are different people, work together. But I think that what we've heard this morning, or earlier this morning, also in terms of the roles that the local people play as decision makers in all of this, is critical as well. And we add these other layers that I've thrown out in relation to changing ecologies and economies. We have quite a mix to manage at this point.
So are we now we're behind? I mean, we're ahead? the only, I don't know if I can bring it back up, but
no,
I could.
We've got a few minutes, but we sort of started behind, so if there aren't any more questions.
I'll just play just a little clip of the Shikona dance. Which gives you a better idea of what it looks like, and in terms of the roles that the musicians are playing, single note, but they're part of a significant whole. The only other thing that I didn't have a chance to say that's important is that this material that's used, and this is from Zimbabwe, but the material that's used for Shikona is an endangered material. It's very rare. And what has happened as a result of this is that musicians do not have access, but they have become creative. And they have been creative, even since Blacking's time. And so then the question comes, why does one tradition get lost? Because the Mutondo tradition is lost, yet this one is continued. And it has a lot to do with the significance of that particular genre. And this is the national dance of the Venda people. The significance in the tradition or in the culture and the opportunities that people will, and the innovation, the adaptation, in the whole process of cultural sustainability that occurs, and I would argue that this is occurring here in relation to this, and as well as some of the other dances that Andrea talked about, because it has such a significant role in the identity, maintaining identity within the culture. So that maybe that helps use up the time.
All right. If there are no more questions, we might thank Jennifer again.